From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last May, President Obama declared it was time to rein in U.S. use of targeted killing by drone. This week, news that the White House has debated targeting an American citizen linked to Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. U.S. drone killings are reportedly down, maybe by half, but it was still hundreds last year. This hour on Point, America's kill list and the future of U.S. drone policy. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is it time to pack up the drones, put them away, or are they out there forever now to be used how, on whom? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. We go first to Washington today for the latest. Greg Miller, staff writer, intelligence reporter for The Washington Post, joins us. Greg Miller, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Word that the White House is debating going after an American in Pakistan. What's known about this person?
Well, not a lot. I mean, we only know of a very small number of Americans who've ever gone to Pakistan to become part of Al-Qaeda. The most prominent one we know of is named Adam Gadam, but he's mainly seen as a sort of media figure for Al-Qaeda, not an operative who would be targeted in a drone strike. And I think the administration is really trying to keep this name under wraps because they feared they don't want to let this person know that they know who he is and where he is and drive him perhaps further underground.
But this seems like a big red flag to that person. I mean, they must have somehow let this come out. Isn't it a kind of a heads up? We're coming for you?
Well, I don't think that they intentionally let this come out. I think that this was the fallout from a hearing last week in which the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee was harshly critical of the administration's counterterrorism policies and alluded to the restrictions in these policies preventing them from killing somebody who they would have ordinarily killed before these policies were adopted, which, you know, just led to lots of questions by reporters, and it sort of figured this out over a period of days.
There's also then a report that the NSA, this is Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill reporting, the NSA is using electronic means to go after, to target drone strikes. Almost they will shoot the cell phone, wherever the cell phone may be, without any eyes on the ground. Is this new?
Well, we looked at this issue as well at the Post. We wrote a story last October on the NSA's role in the drone program, which is extensive. I mean, the NSA contributes significantly to the intelligence that's used in drone strikes. It's as far as I can tell, and what I've looked at, it's not as simple as seeing a cell phone light up and then firing at that device. It is using lots of different technologies to confirm identities, to confirm locations, and to sort of triangulate signals to get targets.
And then there's the issue of who's actually operating our drone program and whether and for how long the CIA will stay involved and whether this gets transferred entirely to the military. Where does that stand, Greg?
Right. Well, this was one of Obama's priorities, was to gradually transfer this authority to the military, with the idea being you won't want a civilian intelligence agency in the job of carrying out lethal operations as part of its core mission. But it's taking a long time, and it probably will take quite a bit longer still. It's complicated from a number of perspectives, technologically, just sort of fitting things together for the Department of Defense and the CIA. But there's a lot of skepticism among senior lawmakers that the Defense Department can do this job as well as the CIA does.
What's known at this point about who's on the American kill list?
Well, we don't know the roster of that list, which changes, you know, month by month. It's updated all the time. It's smaller than it used to be, according to people I've talked to, and it's probably, you know, depending on the location, whether you're talking about Pakistan or Yemen, it's probably in the dozens or so names. But, you know, one of the other things that often gets overlooked is that the majority of drone strikes over the past 4 or 5 years have not even been targeting specific individuals. They have been so-called signature strikes, where you see patterns of behavior by militants, alleged militants, on the ground in Pakistan, and you fire into that target based on what you see without knowing for sure who is in the crosshairs.
We have anything but transparency here. Maybe some curtailment, but still a lot of activity and a lot of interest in this country and around the world about what's going on. Greg Miller with The Washington Post, thanks for joining us today for a few minutes.
Thank you.
Here's a news report out of on an attack in Yemen, people voicing anger there over a campaign. One U.S. drone strike struck a convoy of vehicles traveling to a wedding party in Yemen. This was back in December. Here's NBC's Brian Williams.
The death toll now appears to be 15, with five more injured from a U.S. drone strike in Yemen that missed its target this week and struck what witnesses described as a wedding party. It was the 24th reported drone strike in Yemen so far this year.
24th in a year, raining down that the number of the casualties later rose to nearly 20. Five of those killed were said to be suspected of involvement with al-Qaeda. You got people pushing back hard on this. This was Jeremy Scahill on Monday commenting on President Obama's role in altering the U.S. national security policy to include assassination of U.S. citizens. This is on Democracy Now! Scahill.
I do think it's chilling that we live in an era where a man who won the Nobel Peace Prize and is a constitutional lawyer by training is streamlining and creating a mechanism for making assassination, including of U.S. citizens, a normal part of our what's called our national security policy.
But on the other side, the White House has taken heat from House Intelligence Committee Republican Chairman Mike Rogers, Michigan, for the curtailment, the reining in a little bit of drone policy last year. Here was Mike Rogers saying that these limits are handicapping American security efforts.
Today, individuals who would have been previously removed from the battlefield by U.S. counterterrorism operations for attacking or plotting to attack against U.S. interests remain free because of self-imposed red tape. While we're busy pondering more transparency, our intelligence professionals are left paralyzed because of the totally incoherent policy guidance. So let me be the first to say publicly, the President's May 2013 policy changes for the U.S. targeted strikes are an utter and complete failure, and they leave Americans' lives at risk.
Republican Mike Rogers, Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Spencer Ackerman joins us now from New York, former writer for Wired Magazine's national security blog Danger Room, now national security editor for The Guardian U.S., spent a lot of time looking at technology and policy behind targeted drone killing. Spencer, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
First, the numbers. They're not officially announced. We don't know for sure, but people try and track this. From 2012 to 2013, what's the trend line?
The trend lines appear down, and you can sort of not totally draw an inference about the May 23rd speech last year by President Obama announcing changes to the program as the decisive factor. But nevertheless, it does appear to be influential. In 2013, there were 55 drone strikes across the three major countries in which they occur. That's Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And that's down from about 92 that we can confidently say occurred in 2012. Same sort of thing seems to pertain when looking at casualties. In 2013, they killed as many as 271 people. That's down from an estimate of between 505, 532, the range of that estimate in 2012. And we have a lot of difficulty determining who's a civilian and who is a person slated to be killed, believed to be taking part in militant terroristic activities. But the broad range of the estimate is something like every 1 in 9 to 10 deaths is a civilian.
A significant drop in killings, but still hundreds of killings. Mike Rogers is saying there that we now have a paralyzed intelligence community because of red tape and the pondering of transparency. Does the cutback look deliberate, or does it? Are you hearing complaints from people in the security or military intelligence side of this that their hands are tied now on drones after years of escalation?
What I'm hearing more is a sense amongst security professionals that they've climbed up onto a tiger and they don't know how to get off of it, that the mutations of al-Qaeda that we're starting to see discussed publicly look a lot more like regionally focused organizations, sometimes expressly rebuked by al-Qaeda Central, as just happened with the affiliate in Syria and Iraq by Ayman al-Zawahiri, mm-hmm. the leader of al-Qaeda. And U.S. officials are looking to kind of understand who they ought to be targeting, who poses a threat to the United States, which organizations pose a threat. You know, it's clear that from their perspective, the affiliate in Yemen known as AQAP or al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula it still maintains an interest in attacking the U.S. and that includes at home. But it's far less clear al-Qaeda in North Africa and al-Qaeda in Syria, whether we call them al-Qaeda or not anymore, has that interest or has that desire, let alone has that capability.
So when you say riding a tiger, you mean the policy of drone strikes? Once you pick them up, it's hard to stop them? Why?
Because of all of the different considerations, both bureaucratically and policy-wise, the main thing that Mike Rogers, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, is really pointing at is no one wants to get blamed if there's a successful terrorist attack in the U.S. And so there's a tremendous amount of you might call bureaucratic inertia in trying to rein the program back. That's a lot of what looked to be occurring. This is sort of an observation from outside, from 2010 to 2012, when these strikes were really at their apogee. You heard Greg Miller talk about something called signature strikes, when the United States kills someone, often using a drone, without knowing who that person is necessarily.
Just they're a pattern of activity they recognize.
Exactly,
on the ground.
Wow. What tends to be called pattern of life behavior in intelligence circles. And so when all of those factors come together, it's a lot of countervailing pressure to keep them going as opposed to actually reining them in. And that was something that President Obama kind of nodded to in his May speech last year when he talked about narrowing the target list.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Washington's kill list and drone policy now. A U.S. citizen in Pakistan is said to be, perhaps, the next target. Spencer Ackerman is with us. He wrote the Danger Room blog, national security blog for Wired for a long time. Now he's at The Guardian U.S. We'll hear more views on current U.S. drone policy in a moment. Spencer, go to this. Jeremy Scahill's talked and written about this a lot. And here he is saying that President Obama is streamlining and creating a mechanism for making assassination, including of U.S. citizens, a normal part of our national security policy. What does that refer to? What's he talking about?
Jeremy's talking about something that's commonly known as the disposition matrix, which is something of a bureaucratic euphemism for talking about who goes on to an official U.S. hit list. What are the criteria for including someone on that, and what ought to be done about making that list kind of permanent, a sort of institutionalized process amongst a variety of different intelligence agencies, military agencies, the Justice Department, and up to the White House for keeping it and maintaining it.
So is this the kill list? Is that what we're talking about in effect?
Yeah, what we're talking about in effect is a kill list.
And this American citizen who's now in the news, unnamed, but said to be some kind of al-Qaeda leader in Pakistan, what do you make of that, of the leak or discovery of that debate? How do you interpret it?
First, there's some skullduggery. I would have to believe that Mike Rogers had someone from intelligence agencies discussing it with him to the point that they would underscore that that's an issue for them. So I would imagine that Rogers didn't just come up with this out of thin air. Secondly, the fact that an American citizen has been placed on this list creates the thorniest of all problems for the existence of that list. U.S. citizens, of course, have rights that their government is not supposed to take away from them without due process of law. And this has been something that, as you've seen a handful of Americans in some way, shape, or form sign on with al-Qaeda or some affiliate of al-Qaeda, becoming just less of an impediment to action than an obstacle in some cases for bureaucratic systems to overcome. The case we know most about is Anwar al-Awlaki, the former al-Qaeda propagandist, who U.S. officials used to say was a senior operational planner of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. His father, when it was disclosed that Anwar al-Awlaki was being targeted by the United States for killing, tried to sue to get the basis for targeting him and killing him, and was unable to do so because of official state secrets policy pushed in court by the Justice Department. And it's very difficult to get any kind of transparency on who this person is, what kind of threat they actually pose, and what countervailing factors make assassinating him a policy of last resort as opposed to first resort. The last factor to consider is that when we don't know who this person is, it's incredibly difficult to challenge the basis for it. And the Justice Department's justifications for what constitutes the criteria for killing someone includes the concept of an imminent threat, that this person represents such a time-sensitive danger to U.S. national security that there's really no other option. The trouble is, according to a document that was sent to Capitol Hill, I believe, last year, the definition of imminent is a rather fungible thing and means something quite different than what you and I think of as imminent, which is to say this is going to happen in, you know, within hours or perhaps days. They take a rather fungible sense of it because they feel they can't really know that without confidence and with great confidence. And so that becomes a rather legally significant fact and raises a lot of questions about whether this is a policy of last resort or a policy of first resort.
We're looking at Washington's kill list and U.S. drone policy now. Carl's calling from Montpelier, Vermont. Carl, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I had a simple question, which is, or a statement, which is that until these people are trialed or given a trial, there is no proof that they are guilty of the crimes they've been accused of. They're simply accused. It's the same as if the police accused my neighbor of being a child molester and then went and shot him. If there's not a trial, then they're not proven guilty of what they've done. So we have only the government, you know, accusing them. The Constitution, in its definition on treason, discusses the procedures necessary to be taken, and then you've got the Bill of Rights, which required due process.
What if they believe they know that this American citizen is also an al-Qaeda leader planning an imminent, however they use that word, attack? Does that change your view of things, Carl?
Not in the least. If they have so much evidence, let them put it on the table. If they don't have the evidence to put it on the table, then they're just executing a citizen without a trial and that's unconstitutional.
Carl, we've got it. Let me put President Obama straight to your comment. This was from his speech at the National Defense University, big speech last May. And he said here that U.S. citizens abroad who are planning to harm the country must be stopped, period. Here's the president.
When a U.S. citizen goes abroad to wage war against America and is actively plotting to kill U.S. citizens, and when neither the United States nor our partners are in a position to capture him before he carries out a plot, his citizenship should no more serve as a shield than a sniper shooting down on an innocent crowd should be protected from a SWAT team.
Well, Spencer Ackerman, there's our constitutional lawyer, law scholar Barack Obama, President Obama, you know, with his opinion on what you do in the midst of action and threat. What about the legal justification here? His comparison to a SWAT team and a sniper, or, you know, we killed Bonnie and Clyde. Boom, boom.
Right. Now, here's where a few of the president's words really become very important. And he used the term in that speech, you just heard it, actively plotting to kill U.S. citizens. Well, when you look closer at what the Justice Department considers that to be, what the U.S. government considers that to be, it's actually derived from the affiliation, which is to say that because someone, in the Justice Department's perspective, is a member of al-Qaeda at this level, they don't really need to know whether they are actively plotting to kill U.S. citizens. The fact of that affiliation, they believe, is enough for them to say it's indicated that they intend to do that. Now, this is a really significant question because the other word Obama used and what we've been using on this program is leader. Well, who's a leader? We have a very porous understanding of that. Greg Miller earlier in the program referenced Adam Gedan, a Californian who joined al-Qaeda, I believe, in the late 90s, and he's commonly considered a propagandist. Well, under the definition that you've just heard, Adam Gedan could conceivably be targeted under this because as a member of al-Qaeda, he is presumed to be actively plotting to kill U.S. citizens, even though we've seen no evidence of that. So this becomes a dicey and to some degree circular understanding. And in reference to the U.S. citizen whose name we don't know, who's been identified as coming under U.S. suspicions here, it's been very curious that we haven't seen an indictment of this person. The U.S. was able to indict Osama bin Laden. It was able to indict the bombers of the USS Cole. We've not seen that in this case. We also, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe the U.S. ever formally indicted Anwar al-Awlaki.
And, of course, down he went under a drone strike. What about operationally here? There was much made last May of moving operations here from the CIA entirely to the military. Is that happening? Has it begun to happen? Is the CIA fighting to hang on to it? What's the dynamic there?
Well, the CIA's allies in Congress appear to be rather skeptical of this. Dianne Feinstein, the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has said that she needs to be convinced that the U.S. military would be more discriminating in its drone activities than would the CIA. There's been a whole lot of difficulty determining. In places like Yemen, where both the CIA and the U.S. military, in particular the Joint Special Operations Command, conduct drone strikes, of who's responsible for what. So it's rather difficult to determine when, for instance, the December attack on a wedding party occurred, who in fact bureaucratically and institutionally was responsible for that.
What difference does it make, Spencer? Who pulls the trigger or tracks and pulls?
From the perspective of the person who's having the trigger pulled on it, of course, it makes none at all. From the perspective of transparency, this gets complicated because the CIA has to report all of this stuff, whereas the U.S. military is under, particularly in its special operations functions, actually less stringent authorities. It's, you know, sort of counterintuitive here to report each of its activities to the Armed Services Committees, whereas the CIA has to, in fact, report to them, the intelligence committees, what it does in these cases. So it's actually not a straightforward case of more transparency occurring to the U.S. military. However, the theory goes that if this comes under U.S. military authority, it would be more out in the open because the United States would, possibly have to declare what it's doing. Again, the complication is that the U.S. has a 2001 law called the Authorization to Use Military Force, which talks about an authorization to go after al-Qaeda unbounded by space and by time. So it's sort of curious whether the military, which does take some actions pursuant to the AUMF, would be in any way more restricted should the drone programs transfer entirely to its authorities.
And here's the forever war. Let's hear from a couple more listeners. Eddie in Atlanta, Georgia. Eddie, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yes, hi. I cannot believe we're even debating this issue. These people want to kill my family. These people want to kill Americans. I think once you join a terrorist group, you are no longer an American citizen, and the president has the right to take you out with either a drone or a CIA assassination, whatever it takes. These people are working against us. They want to kill us, all right? And we have the technology. We have some of the best technology in the world called drones. Other countries do not possess this technology. Why should we restrict ourselves from using the ultimate weapon against
them? Eddie, I hear you loud and clear, except on one point, other countries do have drones now and could, hypothetically use them against this country one day. Does that concern you that we get into an era of drone warfare where you've got who knows what kind of drones flying over and shooting down for their own reasons?
I honestly believe the president would not use the drones here on U.S. soil.
No, I don't mean American drones, though that could happen, but I mean we're not going to be the only ones with drones forever, and we're not even now.
I understand that. Like we were the first to develop a nuclear weapon, and other countries have nuclear weapons now. But technology was steady improved.
Ed, we got it. You're leaning in and ready to use. And let me hold that thought right here. We're going to hear a couple of big views on that in just a moment. One more first. Eddie, thank you, in Atlanta. Jeff in Blockton, Iowa. Jeff, you're on.
Hello, Tom.
What do you think?
Yeah, my view is a cautionary use of the drones myself, because I agree with what you just brought up. You know, what's to stop somebody else from using drones against us? I think we need to be very careful using the drones. I'm not saying not use them, but this use is just on suspicion of activity. You know, that leaves it pretty wide open for mistakes. But as far as the American using the drone on the American, I agree with that last caller. You got to look at it like this. He's gone overseas to fight against our Constitution. The Constitution no longer applies to him. He's, you know, light him up.
Of course, you're accepting somebody's description of what he, I guess, is up to, but that's the murky terrain we're on. Jeff, I appreciate your call as well. Let me bring a couple more voices in here. Spencer Ackerman, standby in New York. With us now is Micah Zenko. He's a fellow in the Center for Preventative Action of the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the Council's special report, Reforming U.S. Drone Strike Policies. Micah Zenko in New York, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
And from Memphis, Tennessee, Philip Mudd joins us, former deputy director of the Counterterrorist Center at the CIA, former deputy director of the FBI's National Security Branch, senior intelligence advisor at the FBI for a couple of years there, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, director of the Global Risk at Southern Sun Asset Management. Philip Mudd, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Micah, the president laid this out. There was a lot of heat last spring. The president spoke to drones. His message was, we're going to rein this in somewhat, somehow. A little unclear what and how. Is that happening, Micah? Do we know? Do we know what our own policy is and deployment is at this point?
Well, I give the President Obama a lot of credit for what he did last May, which was for the first time ever to publicly come out and articulate some of the policies that support the use of this this capability. It's important to understand the crucial thing that President Obama did was he basically backtracked from the misperceptions that they had allowed to fester among drone strikes. It had been the contention of the Obama administration before last May that every individual that was targeted was a senior al-Qaeda member who posed a significant and imminent threat of attack to the U.S. homeland. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was never true. Nobody ever believed it was true. And in fact, most of the individuals who have been targeted by CIA drones in Pakistan are engaged in attacking U.S. service members in southern Afghanistan. And so they created this new phrase, which was force protection. And that is the primary reason the U.S. conducts drone strikes is force protection. Individuals who pose a imminent threat to U.S. service members or to U.S. diplomats or to U.S. embassies. So in that extent, it was positive. But the other aspect, which hasn't been discussed, you hinted at it, some of the last callers, is what is the normative precedent that the United States is setting for how other states will develop and use these capabilities? And that is something that worries this administration tremendously. Every administration official contends we need to be more transparent about how we use drones. But when people try to get clarifying information to provide the necessary transparency, so far they've been unwilling to be forthcoming.
What does that suggest? That this is or is becoming a permanent part of U.S. security / military / intelligence global policy? That the world will just have to understand America will rein drone attacks where and when it chooses?
Well, one of the things that the administration has done and has attempted to do, which is they want to put U.S. drone strikes on a more sure footing. They want to institutionalize the practice. They want to have assured host nation access to fly the drones. They want to have the overflight access they need to fly over countries to conduct strikes. They want to have to retain this capability to do it forever. Even if it means doing fewer strikes in certain countries and not opening up new fronts, for example, in North Africa or in Syria, they want to have this on an assured footing to conduct as a presidential tool for as long as they need to do them.
Philip Mudd, what do you think of this as a forever tool of the United States?
I do believe it will be a forever tool. This is a fundamental alteration in the way the U.S. can project power overseas. It gives the president decision beyond saying, do I put boots on the ground or do I do nothing? And I think the definition or the debate about this around terrorism is too narrow. I look at things like drug cartels or human traffickers and say, in decades down the road, when someone poses a threat to America and we can't put U.S. forces in the way of pursuing or capturing that person, what do we do about it? And I think in that scenario, you might consider a drone.
So you're looking at routinizing this, making it almost law enforcement. What you? I mean, seriously, you'd go after, a drug shipment or I don't know what you do with human trafficking. Talk about innocence. You've got plenty of innocence there.
No, I would not make this a tool of law enforcement. I would see a parallel with the war on terrorism. That is, if you can't get to someone who is posing a threat to a child or who is posing a threat to border cities in Texas or California by sending in cocaine or heroin, if you can't get to that person and local security services or police services can't get to them, what is your option? Is your option to allow activity that continues to destroy lives in America, or is your option to intervene? I'm not saying we do it. I'm saying the debate I'm hearing is too narrow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Washington's kill list and American drone policy now. A U.S. citizen in Pakistan may be the next target. Spencer Ackerman is with us. He writes on national security for The Guardian U.S. National security editor there joins us from New York. Micah Zinko is with us from the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Reforming U.S. Drone Strike Policies, a special report from them. And Philip Mudd joins us from Memphis, Tennessee, former deputy director of the FBI's National Security Branch. He's been deep in all this, sits on the advisory board of the National Counterterrorism Center and the for the director of National Intelligence. Philip Mudd, you say this is part of what we do, one of the tools, and we're going to use it, maybe use it in more circumstances. Here's one of our listeners online writes, shouldn't people have the right to prove themselves innocent? And here's another who says, what I worry about is the government flipping things around, wanting to kill a U.S. citizen for other reasons and using a false accusation of being with al-Qaeda as the justification. I mean, after 9/11, there seemed like there was clarity, but things get maybe muddier as we go. Philip, what about that concern?
I can see how someone outside government would have that concern, and I don't believe that this should substitute for an individual's right, particularly an American's right, to defend themselves in court. That's not what we're talking about here.
Well, it is, isn't it? In Pakistan, this guy, he's not going to have a court trial.
That's correct, but neither is a sniper in Los Angeles when the sheriff comes in and says, we can't bring him to trial because he's threatening the city from the top of a building. You can't allow citizenship to be a shield when a human being outside the clutches of American forces is plotting to kill citizens in New York or Chicago or Miami. What's the option? To let the plot continue? I'd say intervene, and the only intervention tool I know of is a drone.
Phil, Micah, what do you say to our listener who's, he might even agree if that were absolutely clear, I don't know, but, you know, this is abusable. That's the point of our Constitution, is how do you know? And, you know, here we are saying, well, we know, trust us, and we're going to kill them.
Well, I would just point out it's remarkably myopic and chauvinistic to be only concerned about this issue when U.S. citizens are being considered for targeting.
Fair enough.
United States has killed something like 3,500 people in Yemen, Pakistan, and Somalia. About 5 or 6 U.S. citizens have died. So 3,500 people have been killed by drones, 5 or 6 U.S. citizens. So if this debate simply is about how the U.S. protects its people and provides due process protections, the way the rest of the world perceives that is fairly negative.
Well, that's quite fair. I think Americans are looking here for some kind of firm ground to put their feet on, though, and at least the Constitution and due process. You know, we at least know historically how we've applied that to our own citizenry. I don't think it's to the exclusion of concern elsewhere, but there are no parameters here that are transparent and clear to most Americans, I think, Micah.
No, I would agree. I mean, there is statements leaked by senior officials to various reporters. There was a section of a speech in May and then a policy fact sheet released by the White House in May. And what people like me try to do is dig through the various adjectives and descriptive language that U.S. officials use and try to understand U.S. policy. But again, if, as President Obama contends, we are setting a precedent for how others will use this capability, and the one thing that we know for sure is that the one thing drones do is they lower the threshold for when states will use lethal force. If other states follow our practice, which is being much more likely to use lethal force outside of its borders, with little transparency and descriptive policies about why we are doing so, that would be a troubling world.
Let's go to Terry in Des Moines, Iowa. Terry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm concerned about the drone program because, in a way, it's an act of terror upon other people. The war on terror has become terroristic itself because they're attacking innocents and killing them. And if we are doing this in other countries, in effect, we're making war on these other countries. And if another country did it to another country, then it would be an act of war. And that's my whole point.
And we're exempting ourselves from that characterization. I mean, I can see that. Spencer Ackerman, what is known about other countries' lethal drone capacity, now or on the drawing board?
The U.S. is overwhelmingly outclassing theirs, but they're coming. We know Iran, for instance, has some strike drones, and they're looking to bolster their capability a lot. Same goes for Israel. Same goes for China. A point that I think sometimes gets overlooked is the technical failings of a lot of these platforms. It's sometimes, I think, your caller earlier talked about this as the ultimate technology. Well, not really. I mean, for one thing, these drones are slower than your typical aircraft. A Predator engine is the descendant of a lawnmower engine. I'm sorry, a snowmobile engine. If you fly them in places with any kind of modern air defenses, they're going to get shot down. If you really see the applicability of drone strikes is really for that of a weak adversary. You wouldn't put them in Pakistan in places where the Pakistani military had its real air defenses, unless, as with the Osama bin Laden raid, you really had a rather stealthy drone, something called the RQ-170 Sentinel. Even that was captured by Iran while it was being used for what we believe was a surveillance mission over Iran, which also points to the fact that these are spoofable and hackable. That's really something that ought to be taken into consideration when considering this kind of public mythos of drones as a kind of omnipotent weapon.
Spencer, what are the prospects in Afghanistan and Pakistan if and when American troops, as they're scheduled to do, increasingly pull out? Would that suggest more drone activity on the other side of American's steep drawdown or even pullout, or less?
Huge and excellent question. Right now, the United States is trying to negotiate what boils down to basing rights for a residual force in Afghanistan in 2014, after 2014. And a huge and unstated aspect of that is where the United States will use its you know, basically air bases and lily pads to launch drones from. No, this is not something that either country really wants to discuss, but at bases like Jalalabad and at Kandahar, those are sites that the United States uses to fly out into Pakistan. Without them, you're really going to see a lot of constraint. The U.S. Navy is working on drones that can launch from aircraft carriers, but they won't be ready until, optimistically, the end of the decade. So that's going to be a real problem. You might, in fact, see some renewed diplomatic shuttling to neighboring countries like Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan to try and set up some new drone bases there.
Could you picture a scenario in which the U.S. has pulled out and now the Taliban is rising? The Afghan capital, Kabul, is under attack, and the U.S. is raining drones around Kabul to try and defend it, it just doesn't work that way?
You can easily imagine that. You can probably more accurately, because the United States is not going to want to be conducting airstrikes over such a populous place, like the capital of an allied country. You'll probably see it more in places like eastern and southern Afghanistan, where long-range surveillance over the course of several days starts to see what may look like training camps or masses of forces preparing for an imminent attack. That's something that, ironically, in, I believe, 2010, a ground commander, a two-star general, sort of alluded to me when we were discussing what you can see now that the U.S. had pulled out of some valleys that it had been patrolling in eastern Afghanistan for a long time, the Karengal Valley and the Pesh River Valley. It becomes, to some degree, this individual suggested, somewhat advantageous to asymmetrical U.S. capabilities like overhead surveillance to be able to sort of see insurgents, terrorists, militants, you know, pick your phrase, amassing in a valley, because then they would be susceptible to airstrikes.
If that's indeed what they are. Tom in Greenville, Pennsylvania. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to call and tell you I support the use of drones for active military support. If we're in a conflict and we have troops on the ground, the use of drones for support of those operations, I think, is fantastic. I don't support the use of it for assassinations, because in an assassination attempt, there's too often collateral damage or an unidentified target, such as a wedding party, that is taken out, and it changes the whole emphasis from an assassination and protection of our country to murder of innocent citizens in another country.
And we have seen that again and again, Mike Zenko points out. I mean, the president spoke to that in his speech last May. Here he was.
Before any strike is taken, there must be near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured. The highest standard we can set.
Philip Mudd, what about that horrible phrase, collateral damage, civilians dying alongside those intended for targeting? And right along with that comes the blowback issue, Philip.
I confess, I'm frustrated and concerned about this use occasionally of the word precision weapon. It leads Americans and others to a belief that somehow war is sanitary and that innocents won't die. We're talking about whether you're killing a terrorist or whether a civilian dies. You're talking about the loss of a human soul. So we have to acknowledge that we are in war. And when we're in war, innocents will die. And regardless, I was on the inside. I watched the preparation where we tried to avoid civilian casualties. Regardless of the effort you put in, if someone's in a house, you cannot guarantee that there's not a woman or child in there. So I think we ought to acknowledge that it's a more precise weapon than a piece of artillery, but that war's hell, and if you get involved in war, innocents will die. On your second question of sort of people phrase it by saying, you know, does this create more terrorists in it? Mm-hmm. Than it kills. I think that's why the president has started talking about pulling this program back, and there are fewer strikes in Pakistan than there have been in recent years. People have started to realize Al-Qaeda Central is on the decline. There are still a few targets left, but by and large, if those targets aren't high profile, I don't think this is a weapon of choice in the war on terror.
Micah Zinko, you know, we're at war, and war comes with death, Philip reminds us, but drones seem to blur the line about war. I mean, the American people's right to oversight of war or whether we're at war. Now, once you get this tool out there and it feels kind of hands-off, though it's very lethal on the ground, how do we keep from sliding into perpetual war? And what about the democracy's role in that determination?
Well, you've raised an important point, which is the United States contends that it's only at war with Al-Qaeda and, quote, associated forces. And when journalists have asked people, what is the list of associated forces, both the State Department and the Department of Defense refuse to provide that information. So an associated force is, again, an internal determination, and we don't know who that is. So we don't know who the United States is at war with. The second point is that it's a misperception to think that the United States only conducts these strikes on behalf of protecting the United States homeland. Again, some of the strikes that we've done, according to reporting by people like at McClatchy, the United States were conducting drone strikes in Pakistan on behalf of close air support for Pakistani army. Uh-huh. Some of the strikes we conduct in Yemen are basically the CIA is serving as the counterinsurgency air force of Yemen. These are individuals who are looking to kill Yemeni soldiers, set up checkpoints, hit Yemeni bases, and we conduct drone strikes on behalf of the government of Yemen to protect them from a domestic insurgency. That is a distinct policy outcome from trying to get individuals who are actively plotting to attack the U.S. homeland.
Yesterday, in a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, the National Intelligence Director James Clapper and Defense Intelligence Agency Director Michael Flynn, they were asked by Senator James Inhofe, Republican, Oklahoma, if after a decade of being hunted, Al-Qaeda is diminishing. You'll hear Inhofe, then Clapper, then Flynn.
Yes or no, each one of you. Is Al-Qaeda on the run and on the path to defeat?
No, it is morphing and franchising itself, not only here, but other areas of the world.
Mm-hmm.
They are not.
Micah Zinko, no, it's not on a path. Morphing, franchising, other areas of the world. Americans might wonder if that means that drone attacks will follow that morphing and dispersion.
Well, there's been a lot of people who, for a living, develop targets of individuals who the president and his senior advisors, the civilian, decide to strike. But I give the administration a lot of credit, which was there was a lot of pressure to open up strikes, for example, in Libya and in Mali a year ago. And there's been a lot of pressure now to open up strikes, in particular against extremist elements in Syria. The question is, are these individuals primarily engaged in domestic insurgencies, in which case the United States should have a separate debate of whether or not we want to be intervening on behalf of what are domestic civil wars, or are these individuals actually currently actively plotting for international strikes against the U.S. homeland or against U.S. Diplomats and embassies and et cetera. And I think it's very easy to mix up those individuals under the umbrella of Al-Qaeda and associated forces.
Spencer, where do you see American drone policy going then? Settling into it's always there for any president under any circumstances with a kill list that the American people don't know? Is that the status quo?
Yes, and probably an expanded status quo. The U.S. isn't really investing so much more in buying new drones or new numbers of or increased numbers of the ones that it already has, but it's institutionalizing and regularizing, routinizing the use of this tool, and something that you really see throughout a variety of military technological innovations is once the tool exists, it proliferates. And different bureaucratic institutions find that they would like to use this thing as well, and they would like to see what it can offer them. Additionally, there's a lot of pressure, both budget-wise and from the perspective of a public that's often described as war-weary, not to invest a tremendous amount of boots on the ground in a lot of different places. And so this becomes viewed as something of a panacea, that a drone is an alternative to what the public understands to be war, which speaks to Philip's point. That's not really correct. It's another instrument of waging the same campaign. But it does, you know, become a lot more of an out-of-sight, out-of-mind phenomenon, and that serves a lot of bureaucratic interests rather well.
Michael Zinka, we just have half a minute here. Is there an element of transparency that would give you more comfort on behalf of, let's say, Americans in understanding exactly what's going on under their name?
Well, this policy is traditional military activity, and as such, it should be conducted by the U.S. military and not be conducted by the Central Intelligence Agency. And until you have that final move from the CIA to the Department of Defense, unfortunately, there is very little openness and transparency that the White House can engage in.
There we are, up to date on our drone policy, and it clearly isn't over. In fact, maybe settling in for a long time here. Plenty for Americans to think about right there, and others around the world. Michael Zinka at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you very much for joining us from New York today.
Thank you.
Philip Mudd in Memphis, great to have you with us. Mr. Mudd, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And Spencer Ackerman with The Guardian, U.S., joining us from New York. Spencer, thanks for your insights today.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. Tomorrow in this hour, American teens are stressed. We'll look at the sources of that stress and maybe some solutions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.